Hello and welcome to the Scripts and Scribes Social, our casual chat show where we converse with some of our favorite industry folks. We hope you're staying safe and healthy wherever you may be. Today we're chatting with a lit manager and producer who's worked at William Morris, UTA, and Hollywood Gang at Warner's. He's a great rep with a solid client list of working writers and an even better human being. He is Scott Carr. Hey, how are you, Scott?
I'm doing well, all things considered. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, no, it's always great to talk to you.
You as well.
So, obviously, the first question is, how are you handling the quarantine? I know you're a big workout guy. How are you getting your workouts in these days?
Yeah, I'm an avid gym goer. That got shut down a couple months ago. But, you know, I've had a lifetime of working out in different environments, different styles. So I've been bike riding in more remote areas. I'll drive outside the city and then bike through the canyons where there's not a lot of foot traffic or cars. Work out in my backyard. I have a gated backyard, and I have, you know, some hand weights and stuff. And I do a lot longer dog walks now with my pup. So that's kind of my go-tos right now. And it seems to be good for maintenance, but I am eager to get in something that will be a little bit more diverse.
Yeah, no, I bet. But it's good to stay. You're staying physically active. It can be difficult, obviously. The first few weeks were brutal.
Yeah, it was hard to feel motivated when there's so much fear and concern out there. So you just kind of have to push through that. And now more than ever, it's important to remain as active as you can safely, because our immune systems are being compromised and our stress related hormones are going to be increasing. So it's very important to get sunlight and exercise and proper nutrition. I'd encourage it more so than ever right now. Especially when we come out of this, we're going to make sure that our bodies are healthy enough to not have any fallout once we're getting back to being more active and being outside and around more germs and whatnot.
Yeah. How's the quarantine affecting your business and that of your clients?
Well, I don't go to the office anymore, but I can work from home, and a lot of what I do is virtual over email and phone and reading and whatnot. So that's actually, the flow of that has been relatively not disrupted. The clients, the writer clients, can always kind of work from home, which where most of them work anyway, and continue to write and work on their assignments. Or if they're working in TV, it's a switch to a virtual room. I only had one director that was shooting, but fortunately he finished his shoot the day before the quarantine started. So he's been in post.
Wow.
Which is being done remotely. So he's not in the same room with the editor and he's seeing scenes being sent to him and stuff. So it's not ideal, but it's better than having your movie shut down.
Right.
And I have a couple of projects that are in post ready for release, but we're still trying to figure out the best way to go about that in a world where people aren't watching movies in movie theaters. People are purchasing things in a very different manner. So we're just trying to strategize with our various partners on how to go about doing that. And yeah, it's only been a couple of months, so I think I've got my sea legs on the current landscape, and we'll see, you know, what happens when it comes to, you know, trying to expose material in a way that we're trying to seriously figure out a way to get it made and what that needs to look like in a post-corona world. So there's still various unknowns, but for now it's just do the work and then we'll strategize when it's ready.
Right. Obviously, physical production, shooting of films and TV shows is for the most part halted. I know there's a few things that are still shooting, but it's really sort of independent, sort of television-y kind of things. Like you see virtual shoots, like late night shows on via Skype or Zoom or something like that. But for the most part, production is pretty much halted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously it's going to restart at some point, hopefully relatively soon. But, you know, it all depends on how the quarantine is lifted and testing and vaccines and all that. But as well, some development I know is continuing. And from what I understand, like animation's doing well. But staffing has slowed greatly. There are rooms that are currently working, but those usually staffed before or at the early stages. And but what's your game plan for your clients to for things for them to do to be ready for when, I don't want to say the gates open, because we were talking about it before we started recording, that I don't know if it's going to be the floodgates opening where all of a sudden every production is open, but it'll probably be more in stages. But at the same time, once production starts ramping up again, once insurance companies feel comfortable insuring casts and whatnot, they will start to ramp up production probably fairly quickly in different areas, depending upon what's able to be shot in a reasonable and safe fashion. What sort of game plan are you having as a rep, if there's any sort of special plans that you're making or you want to have available and ready? And what are you encouraging your clients to have ready?
Mm-hmm. So many of my clients right now were previously working on assignments. So it's for them, it's really about just getting through their workload. And hopefully by the time they become available, everything is relatively normalized. So we don't have to make any kind of like prognostications or pivots for the new world that we live in. For people that have time on their hands to write or will shortly, while we're probably still in the current circumstance, it's just about, as always, encouraging them to have the motivation to continue to use their time most productively. Continue to generate ideas. You know, we vet them together. There may be certain parameters in which we're considering a material we want to immediately expose on the heels of this, maybe the scale of it, for instance. There may be a more gradual expansion into larger productions. And if someone has an idea that is, you know, more contained or smaller production that wouldn't require as many people, then it would make a lot of sense to kind of lean into something like that if it's going to be ready relatively soon, just because it would be more practical to put out there, right, into that world that we'll probably be in for many, many months after this. As soon as something is ready, like as soon as I'm really excited about it and happy with the state of the material, it's unlikely I would sit on it until like everything felt fine, because people are reading, people are buying, they are knowing this is going to at one day end and they're going to get back to business per usual. I don't believe this is changing the face of our world forever. I don't think movie theaters are going to go away. I don't think people are not going to be able to have makeout sessions in movies anymore.
Right.
So, we will reach a point where I think we'll look back on this like we have every crisis and say, remember that time that this happened, but life has gone on. So once something's ready, it's really about just thoughtfully assessing the landscape and putting it out there in the most strategic way with the right timing. And, you know, just trying to be proactive and continue to generate opportunities for clients so that we don't get static with this state of fear and concern, at least not in a way that feels it's negligent or irresponsible. Like, we should be able to say, this makes sense now. Let's start to put this out there. It may be a slower roll to make sure something's not burnt off too soon if for some reason people aren't leaning in based on their own mood or their own work circumstances. But I would be very unlikely that I would say we're just going to stop the presses until we know what's going on. So in the meantime, it's about just continuing to write and work and get the best material possible for film. And in television, people are actively looking to work and staff. We're all paying close attention to what is ramping up from a staffing standpoint, what rooms are opening or what mini rooms are opening. And then that's just business as usual, reaching out, making a submission, doing a follow-up, trying to get a virtual meeting, try to get them an offer, and then put them in that room. And then that'll be a virtual process thereafter. And there's a lot less of that going around right now because people are unsure about kind of what they're picking up and when they can start shooting again. Mm-hmm. But they do have to move. They can't just stop the machinery and start a room when this is all completely over, because it's going to take 6 months for a room to get to a place where they'd even have something to shoot as a series.
Right, right.
Because we're already past pilot season where they were only shooting a single episode. Now they're talking about series orders and cable and streaming material that only pick up series orders. So rooms are active. There's just less of them and they're more virtual.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very similar to what it was. It's just about finding the information and being aggressive about getting people the opportunities.
Right. And you had mentioned contained scripts. If a writer out there has an idea for a contained movie, but hasn't written it, is that something you think they should pursue because of the time frame, or just focus on what you think is your best material, best idea, and go with that regardless of the scope?
Well, I would say if the contained idea isn't relatively strong, then it's probably not worth pursuing under any circumstance.
No, sure.
If they're really passionate about it and they do think that they can do an outstanding job on it, it's going to be a great representation of their sensibility, of their craft, then it makes also practical sense to maybe lean into that, because it would make more sense for something to be viable sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a little bit more of a tactical advantage potentially to that. And contained material will always have a place in the market because it's a scale thing. It's a budget thing. Not everything can be huge, obviously. So I think it makes a lot of sense for people to be thinking a little bit more like that if it's organic to what they want to be writing. I wouldn't have someone reverse engineer their sensibility into that space when they're really more about something that's more expansive or dynamic in what they ultimately want to be writing.
Right.
So that's kind of my take on that.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. What about, and I've seen a few writers mention to me, oh, I have an idea. And the idea has elements of coronavirus. Like they're telling coronavirus stories now. They're writing them now. Is that something you think will be marketable in the near future? Or is it something like years later, like after a tragedy or after a huge event? Sometimes it takes the public time to sort of be able to accept these things, and other times they want it right away. So what's your take on that?
My instinct is more likely the latter, that I think especially this event is ongoing for so long, it's going to create fatigue.
Sure.
That I don't think people are going to want to like just go out and see that story dramatized or sensationalized or romanticized or whatever you're going to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, it comes down to someone's personal creative instincts. Like, you never know. Like, I can't read the future tea leaves about what's going to happen. But if someone asked me for my personal opinion on what I think they should be spending their time on, I would not be opportunistic about the environment and thinking that relevancy is going to enhance the viability of what they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
I think people will be more apprehensive about it. So that's kind of like just my overview on that in a very general sense.
Right. Now, you talk to tons of executives and producers, and I'm just curious as to what you're hearing, or what sort of the predictions are, if you are privy to many of them, about what the timeline is looking for. I know it's still all up in the air, and it's definitely nothing is set in stone, and people are still trying to figure it out as they go.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have any sort of feeling about, from your industry contacts and on the production side, or the development side, on what they're looking towards, what they think is coming?
Yeah, I don't have anything concrete, obviously, just from what I've been reading in the press or talking about with people. I know people are certainly eager to get back to work in the safest, most responsible way. All productions are always going to have gatherings. They're always going to have a lot of people that have to congregate around each other and touch the same things and everything. So I think everyone's focused first and foremost on safety. And, testing and anything that they can practically be doing to create an environment where people are going to feel safe, because it's really going to be about whether or not people are comfortable going into those work environments, because a lot of them are elective. Like actors, many of them don't have to work if they don't want to at this point. So is it going to be, are actors going to feel safe going into that space? So I think everyone wants to create like this environment where they've really proven to the talent, to the people that are going to be handling things and being in close proximity to one another, that that it is safe. And if they get to a point where safety feels like it's taken precedence over fear, then I think things will start to ramp back up into the smaller scale productions, and the ways in which people feel like they can just start to feel like they're getting back into the flow of working. Because everyone, for the most part, that does this job, they do it because they are passionate about it and they love it. And they want to be creators and they want to contribute to the entertainment industry with their storytelling. So I think there's a definite eagerness to get back to it. It's really about safety becoming more prevalent than people's fear. And once we get a better bead on the danger level, because fear and danger are two different things, and right now we're in a high state of fear and a relatively and the danger factor is very real, but it's still unknown. We don't quite know what all this data is going to ultimately filter out to until we get much closer to a post-mortem state. So I think as we get a clearer sense of like how you can properly protect yourself, or that the threat has been mitigated, or that it's been mainly contained, then I think things will get back to work. And I think the mandate is sooner rather than later. I don't think our industry is going to be the last one to ramp up, because it takes so long to get a product into the market.
Right.
And they know when they start to when they have something ready can take, you know, many months, if not much longer. So I think they want to get back into that phase as quickly as they can while doing it safely. And I'm sure every production company, every studio, every television network are having daily active conversations about how they can proceed forward and not remain in the stasis, while keeping a close eye on, you know, the recommendations of the medical professionals and the government, and just all trying to fall in line, because there's liability concerns, there's insurance concerns, there's optics, there's politics. There's all these other factors too that are going to influence their thinking and their methodology. So that's all kind of a stew that's being mixed up right now. But I think the mandate is we're trying to figure this out. As more time goes on, more jobs are lost. There's a need, like the demand is outweighing the supply right now, as people sit at home and want to watch stuff, right, at least in the non-theatrical realm. And you know, you don't realize how small those libraries truly are until they run till several months go by with new stuff.
Right, right.
Or at least the desire to watch it, because you're going to watch a fraction of the stuff on those platforms anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everyone is super eager and working diligently to try to figure this out. In terms of time frame, it'd be purely a guess. We already know that there is some shooting slowly ramping up in other parts of the world. I'd like to think that as we get into the fall, you know, our weather will be nicer, even nicer in most parts of the world. I think post Labor Day will be a time where I think we're going to start to hear of more things getting back into full swing with safety precautions and health concerns in place. And I think it'll be, I don't think it'll be until 2021 or there is an active vaccine that things are, you know, back to relative normalcy. I think that is a 2021 realistic agenda,
right?
Because we just know how long it takes to create a vaccine, and this spread was obviously way too widespread by the time we really tried to get in front of it, as the numbers continue to ramp up. So I think we've hit a critical mass. We're past the point of no return where it's out there and we can't stop it.
You're right.
So now we're just trying to like keep everything, you know, minimize as much damage as possible. But containment, I think, is going to be tough to do within like that whole time frame of if everyone stopped moving and then a month the virus would be dead. I think there's too much civil unrest and there's too much misinformation for people to prescribe to that anymore, as well as the devastating economic hardships that everyone is now starting to feel more and more each week. So mm-hmm. I think we're at a point of coping rather than realistically having this gone from our environment anytime soon. I'm not hopeful that we're just going to wake up in a month and there's no more cases.
Yeah, if only, right?
Yeah, one could hope, but it doesn't seem practical at this point.
Obviously, shooting a film and television, there are some logistical differences. Films usually, especially big budget films, being slightly larger. But on the other end, because of the fact that movie theaters are shut down and likely will be further out for opening than other things like restaurants and things like that, still sooner than concert venues and sporting events, which I think are much further down the road. But do you think that, or maybe I should say, how does that affect the market? Because it does take a long time for a film to shoot and then go through post-production because the demand may not be there right away. Whereas in television, the demand is sort of immediate. If you're able to shoot a show and you can get it out, you have a captive audience. You have people wanting to put eyeballs on that. Whereas in a film, like we're seeing, like you had mentioned earlier, we've seen them holding films or going straight to VOD immediately on a few cases. And so is the demand lessened, do you think, in the immediate sense, to develop features as opposed to television? I know they're two different arms. It's not the same executive. So they each have their own agendas and their own progressing at their own pace. And one does not preclude the other. Does it affect the feature market more so, since the timeline seems to be extended over TV, or it really doesn't matter because the lead time is so great? And just a guess.
I think just given that nowadays theatrical motion pictures that really compose the market share of what drives people to the theater are these much bigger scale films. And they are going to be the last to ramp up on that scale.
Right.
Because in order to even to keep the budget down to that low, they have to be working 12 hours a day without restrictions. When you add in all these restrictions and it's going to take twice as long to shoot those movies.
Mm-hmm.
If like people are having to move more slowly and be more cautious versus just if
you temperature checks before you go on set.
Yeah, if you've been on a set, it's a frenetic environment where people are not concerned about bumping into each other, breathing on each other, touching the same objects and food.
Right.
If all that becomes a concern, a shooting day is very expensive, and the whole budget revolves around the number of days that they shoot, at least a production budget. So like if they have to extend those and those movies become even more impractically expensive, and then there's a greater risk they're not going to do as well in the theater for quite some time because a lot of people won't return to the theater out of fear. If they do reopen the theaters, it'll probably be not packing people on top of each other anymore. It'll be like every fourth seat is blocked off and that's the way you're watching. You can't be directly in front of or behind anyone. There might be that whole dynamic put in there. So I do think that the large scale theatrical market has been really taken the brunt of the film industry's long-term fallout. And I think the films that are done, like the movies that are sitting in the can or in post-production, they're going to be the ones that'll be coming out first, provided they don't eventually just dump them on video on demand. And when they come out might be those mitigating factors we talked about. So they can't have the opening weekends they have, but it's something's better than nothing. And people at some point will want to get out of their houses and do things that they can do outside safely, like go to the theater or sit down restaurants with mitigation practices. So, you know, those will be the films that will be the litmus test. They will be the canaries in the coal mine that show whether or not people going to the movie theaters is something that is lucrative for the industry. And when, like, it will at some point all regain its footing, but they're going to try to see how well a Chris Nolan movie does in the theater in July, for instance, a movie that would typically track and open to like very high volume. If it's half as much for a movie that still costs the same amount of money, they're gonna have to rethink their strategy on timing, because there's no point in putting something out to have it kind of get a soiled bite at the apple.
Right.
And they're constantly tracking like how well things are doing on VOD, like when Trolls opens and does $100 million over several weeks, and we'll see how Scoob does this Friday. Stuff that keeps kids entertained while they're sitting at home and not working is a really good strategy. I think that stuff works well. So I'm hopeful those films will do well on video on demand, but I don't think that adversely affects their thoughts of saying, let's not go to theaters with them. Cause I think people are still want to create that experience and make sure that they create out of home experiences and activities for people to do as a family. So I think the theatrical market is going to be is going to be paying close attention to how these finished films do when they come out, and when they can shoot the new ones or resume shooting the big ones. That is going to be, I think, the last phase of Hollywood's return to normalcy. When a Marvel movie starts shooting again, then we're probably in good shape.
And what about television in terms of the streaming numbers? Supposedly are up substantially for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. Do you think, especially with the rising or the lowering supply, meaning they're pushing out what they have already in the pipeline and needing to get more, or do you see a rise in development? Like they're trying to get additional shows, or there may be shows that were on the bubble getting picked up, or shows that were during the pilot stage, shows that may not have been picked up getting picked up and going to series. Do you see more development, more active development in television than would have been expected previously?
I think shows that were maybe on the bubble could see themselves saved by this, because they won't be able to pick up as many brand new things because they didn't get far enough in. Mm-hmm. Or maybe some of that stuff had like, it's a bigger risk because it doesn't have any awareness to it now. And they had a show that, you know, did relatively good, but they thought they could do better with something else. That's now become the greater risk because they don't know if they can fully ramp that up fast enough. And with these other shows, they have established rooms. They have a broken down season two. They could get into their virtual room right away. They could have things ready, and they could constantly be adjusting for new productions. They have a workflow in production. They have a crew. There's a lot more of a shorthand to that production. So I think those bubble shows might be, a lot of them will be revived for those reasons. In terms of new shows, yes, I think anything that was, they were excited about making, they're trying to figure out how to make the greenlit content that was on the starting block. But again, it's going to come down to safety and all those elements of how they can shoot those things practically and responsibly. But I assure you, they're all working very diligently to figure that out now, because they've got to be able to supply those pipelines quickly. The shows that were kind of in development that they had high hopes for, but really didn't know, I think that's just going to continue in development until they get to a point where they're ready to decide if that's something they would want to make. And then they might bypass a pilot scenario for them and go right to series and try to figure that out, because they just don't have the time to do that additional vetting step. They just have to like commit to it and then figure out a way to shoot it, because when you shoot a pilot, then stop shooting and then pick it up and then build out the room again and then write the other episodes and go back to production on that. Like that's like it's a time consuming process where they might want to collapse some of those steps and just figure out the most efficient way to go about it. And anything that needs a full series, like they picked it up to series, but they're not going to start shooting for many, many, many months, because they want to write those 8 to 10 or several episodes, break the season, send those writers off to write. I think that's still in full effect. If anything, they can be saying, we should be filling rooms, we should be developing scripts, we should be getting our stockpile ready, so the moment we can pull the trigger on production, we're going to have a show with a large volume of scripts that we like and have developed thoroughly, so we can go out and make those and get that back on air as quickly as possible. So I think that's probably the most safe environment in television right now, which are rooms, that shows that are greenlit, they know they want to make, they've built a room, and they're all working virtually through Zoom, and then they'll all go off and write their scripts. That's actively been happening that I don't that even that didn't even really stop. Like everyone kept working in those environments. They just immediately went virtual.
Right. And I had heard that a lot of rooms, obviously, like you said, continued, but staffing seems to have slowed down substantially. What's your take on that? When do you feel like the staffing will, if it returns to normal, when it'll get close to that sort of stage when a bunch of networks and companies are rushing to do staffing in terms of a staffing season like that, you know, networks?
I don't think the conventional staffing season, which really only exists in broadcast, is going to see its regularity until next season, provided everything is back to normal, because this pandemic hit right when the pilots were being shot. So now what they already knew the shows that they were going to pilot on that could potentially go to series. So some of them like got a few days in, some of them didn't start, some of them were close to finishing. So like I think they're all just trying to sort through the bodies and figure out which ones of these kind of nascent series is we are going to try to figure out how to build a room around in this greenlit a series without a finished pilot, mm-hmm. or figure out a way to finish the pilot if possible and then proceed. But this is going to be so ongoing for so many months, and they already had their roster teed up. They're just going to try to figure out the most practical way to commit to those players on that team and move those forward. When it comes to like a full blown, you know, ramped up staffing season where everybody is crashing to the hoop, trying to figure out how to get their writers into those coveted those rooms that are being picked up. Mm-hmm. We're not going to see that until next year. The only caveat might be is if they really can't commit to anything, and then there is a floodgate of shows that they are going to go and try and make, like say in the fall or the winter, because they really had to wait for safety precautions to get to a stage where they said, okay, now we know we can go off and make these, and they're going to actually build new rooms out of them because those other rooms are now finishing up. It could potentially shift the paradigm to a different season, but I think this is going to be so ongoing given the state that we're in with like the constant increase in cases and all the fallout. I think that like we're not going to be in recovery mode until next year anyway. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be in triage mode financially and from a health scare for the majority of this year. If anything, on a fear factor, like danger is another thing. We have to figure out the data to determine that. But I think everyone's going to be really apprehensive for the remainder of this year. Because once we hit Labor Day, then we run into like major holidays of Christmas and Thanksgiving, and things start to slow down a little bit anyway. And we're so used to a certain flow and a certain like seasonal approach. It's a big ship with a small rudder. It's not very nimble. So I think it might be almost like we're writing it off. We're going to work with what we have. We're going to try to get back to business as safely as we can, as quickly as we can, while paying close attention to the regulations. And we're just going to cross our fingers that come, you know, first quarter 2021, we can, you know, restart the machinery per usual. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, those shows that were on the bubble will try to pick up some of the slack. Or those shows that they did move forward with partially are going to try to keep going with the ones that they believed in most. There may be less material hitting the airwaves and programming and streaming for the rest of this year. You know, and that just might be, you know, we're in a time of scarcity. So, you know, we're as a society, we may have to adapt to the fact we can't have as much as we thought we could have across the board of our lives. And then, you know, once things have been better regulated and we can just then get back to business and back to realizing that, you know, the abundance is returning.
I've got a few listener questions I wanted to run by you.
Mm-hmm.
The first, Jack asked, if Scott was queried by a new writer with incredible IP, great pilot, pitch deck, Bible, ideas for further seasons. So it's talking about one show, I guess.
Yep.
And that writer
Jack's show.
and that writer has no other scripts written. Would the nature of being a lit manager cause Scott to not be interested in looking at this, quote, one-trick pony writer?
No. Like, again, most of us, even in quarantine, we still remain busy, and we're not going to read a plethora of material before we decide if someone is talented or viable. We're going to look at one piece of material. If what they present as their touch point, as their sample, ends up being a very strong piece of material that has market value, then that's what we're going to want to activate first anyway. And while we're going through the process of further developing that and figuring the strategy and the timing for that, then it'll be put back on the writer to continue to generate new ideas. Like I've never been a type of representative that says, I won't take a bet on someone with a one strong piece of material and trust that it's not a fluke, and that we'll create other ideas and other material as we go while figuring out the exposure that or thereafter. So if that is Jack's best foot forward, and like, because if he has nothing else, I assume it's because he has nothing else he's ready to prepared to share, because that was kind of like his training ground, and this was the one that he felt got him into the big leagues, because there always is kind of that script. And that's it. If it's the first thing he's literally ever written, it just puts a greater risk for him, whether or not Jack is truly ready to put himself out there into the inboxes of representatives that will probably not allow him back to that well if it's a shit the bed piece of material. So he's going to have to make sure he does his thorough vetting through friends and contests and consultants and whatever it is, reading material and objectively comparing it to his before he kind of says, okay, now I'm ready to put it in the inbox of a lit manager or an agent or a representative of any kind. That's on him. But he should be completely comfortable with one really strong piece of material and then maybe having some backup ideas. But people who think they have their script perfect and then go off and write five more perfect scripts, I think they might be wasting time in the behind the scenes too much. Like, if you're eager to get started and get professional counsel, do your training ground, get your best piece of material ready, make sure it's thoroughly vetted, and put yourself out there and see if you're ready, versus just staying back and writing all these amazing scripts and then keeping them in your backlog. And most of them probably aren't amazing anyway, so they're going to have to put themselves out there at some point and see where they stand in a professional capacity. Just not too early, not too late. So you got to kind of find the Goldilocks time frame.
Right. And it actually segues into another question that I get asked a lot and gets brought up a lot. Obviously, everyone loves an incredible IP, and you, in terms of if your script is a pilot, they have a great pilot. That's obviously, you know, having a great spec, whether it's feature or pilot, is important. But if you are a TV writer, want to write in television, and you've got a great pilot, that's your sample. What else is necessary if you decide you want to take that out, try to develop it, whatever? He mentions pitch deck, Bible, ideas for further seasons. How much of that do you like to see?
I think if the pilot's not ready or just isn't strong enough, all those other materials are a waste of time and unnecessary. I think it's best to put a writer's time, energy into really making sure that they have the strongest version of their pilot. Now, maybe in creating the best version of the pilot, they did need other materials so that the pilot feels like it's got the seeds that speaks to a series. And maybe they did have to generate that material. But that's more, I think, used for the development of the pilot, not necessarily to fully complement the package of content just yet. Eventually, if the pilot is strong enough, then we're going to need to see other materials, provided a representative feels it's something they want to take out into the space for development. If it's more of a writing sample and just doesn't feel like it's going to get traction in the development space, but it is an excellent piece of material to get them meetings, get them fans, potentially get them into a staffing opportunity, they don't need those materials at all, because that's never going to be asked for. So sometimes it's the best to have a representative really kind of determine that, yes, this is something we should lean into development. Now we need those materials. And they have a loose sense of what that is. But they didn't spend months writing other episodes, putting together a pitch deck. Like, I think sometimes they're putting that together is not the best use of their time. Like, if you do it and it ends up working out, then it ended up you made the right gut call in developing it. But it might become a waste of time if it's not necessary to utilize those materials. So I think that's writers have to keep in mind that pitch decks and all those supplemental materials are only necessary for the market if it's going to be a piece of material that's going to be exposed for development. And many, if not most, original television pilots, writer representatives feel are like, this is more like your writing sample.
Right.
This isn't worth something like, you know, that's a very special check boxes that have to be checked to feel like this is something that we can put out there in a way that we can actually sell this and get it on the pathway to potentially getting made. Mm-hmm. So that's just something they should keep in mind. If they feel they want to develop those materials, I'd say it's more because they think it's enhancing the creative quality of their pilot, because it is a show. It's not a contained idea that ends at page 60 forever. It needs to go on for many, many, many more episodes, ideally. So if they feel like they're setting up their characters and their storylines in a way that leaves us wanting more, and that came from the thorough development of what they think this series is at the end of season one, at the end of their overall series, where these character journeys are going, then that could enhance the quality of their pilot, and then it could be worthy of that. But those materials are not what we're going to need in order to determine whether or not that writer has written something really well. It's going to be how it shows up in that pilot script.
Right. Now, Gustavo asked, and it's actually a number of questions, so I'm just going to kind of read and I guess answer as you go, and then I can ask some more. I mean, let's say it's a couple of them here. Gustavo asked, what do you as a lit manager and producer look for in a client? How can you tell if a story from a writer, whether it is a pilot or feature, interests you? Okay, let's start with the first one first. What do you as a lit manager and producer look for in a client?
Well, there's two halves to that question. One is what they put on the page, and then the other is what they kind of bring to the process with their personality and the way they comport themselves professionally thereafter. But on the page, you know, someone who has a really strong command of their voice and craft and has clearly read a bunch of scripts and done enough writing, or they're kind of a savant that writing came so naturally to them that they have a cinematic command of their language, and it just pops and it pulls us in like a movie or television show pulls you in with their images and their storytelling that still has to exist on the page with their words. So that kind of grabs me from the outset. Usually before even reading the material, someone who has a really compelling log line, something that feels like it's a dynamic, fresh idea that's rife with conflict, and it feels like it has an interesting castable character or characterizations to it. Like, you know, putting effort into that is going to ultimately have us open up the PDF. So someone who could do that well usually is at least figuring out that this aspect of a story, the conceit stage, is really vital to what we're ultimately going to try to do with that hopefully well-written piece of material when we talk about it in more of a short form process of phone calls and pitches. Mm-hmm. About getting people to read it, not just leveraging our relationships to get them to read it. And, you know, someone who thinks in a real original capacity, like an idea that feels like people aren't really leaning in or haven't really gone down that path of a story. I think I'd rather pull someone back from going too far with the boldness of their idea rather than cutting too close to the cloth of what's been done or what they think people are looking for. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they have permission to be really outlandish. As long as it feels like it's worthy of someone's experience, that they're like, that story makes me curious to want to experience that, then, you know, really go outside the box on what it is. And ideally, you know, if you can draw something from your own personal experience or from your own special sensibility, so it really kind of like speaks to your voice, so that like when people read that and meet you, they see some consistencies. I think that all will best serve the, you know, the ongoing relationships and how they look to that person for a certain kind of story, because they've got a prototype and they seem to really understand that world really well. So, you know, a writer should lean into their strengths of what makes them original, while also doing all the necessary training so that when they're putting pen to paper and finally putting out in the world, it really feels like they've kind of Malcolm Gladwell'd their way there and they've spent their 10,000 hours really working on their crafts, because they're not going, when they're going to representatives and they're going to the industry, they're not stepping into high school from elementary school.
Right.
They're stepping into the NFL,
mm-hmm.
but they were relatively unknown until then. So it's almost kind of like they're going from obscurity to the big leagues for the most part, unless they kind of climb through the ladder of the industry through getting a job as an assistant and building their own relationships and whatnot. They're being plucked from virtual obscurity and put in the big show. So they have to be diligent about their own training behind the scenes. Otherwise, we're going to sniff out that they're not ready for the big leagues.
Right. The second part of the question is, how can you tell if a story from a writer, whether it is a TV pilot or a feature, interests you?
Well, it comes down to like personal taste. Like as a representative, my taste has to be and is relatively prolific, because my job is to facilitate the vision of my client's storytelling, what they want to put out in the world. So it's not necessarily what I need to want to see on my television every week. It's stories I think that there is an audience for that I can put out there to various relationships to have those relationships then take on their own form and then autonomously operate while I kind of manage it from behind the scenes. So like I'm drawn to something that feels like, it really feels like it's imbued with someone's personal passion and spirit, and that I get excited infectiously by the way in which they go about telling their story. And I can tell that they care about it and that they spent time on it. And it just, I can't stop thinking about it because of its originality or because of how well written it was or the bold choices that were made. Like, otherwise I'd just be saying, you know, what are the movies that I like? And writers should write what they like. And then I'll be there to advise if I think there's an audience for this, there's a way to facilitate this into the market. So I just look for people that it feels like they've written something that really excites them.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems to happen to have that strong enough tentacles to reach other people's interests.
Right.
So that's more contextual and conceptual. Like, you know, the specificity of that I could only really determine once I'm looking at it.
Sure. That does sort of lead into the next question. It's actually a long one from the same Gustavo. Wanted mm-hmm. to know, what are the elements you look for in a script? Like its unique vision, it's written so visually amazing, it has something that can sell big time, or something else?
I'm really drawn to character-facing material. Like, because I think at the end of the day, a human being wanting to play that role and bring it to life emotionally is an important aspect of building a quality piece of material. So someone who really seems to have a deep understanding of the human condition and the way that the emotions can formulate and brought to life in a dramatized way, like I do. Like as a process, if someone starts with a character, I do think that their heart is in the right place. Now that character has to be put into a compelling story with a very interesting concept that's fresh and easy to digest, ideally when it comes to viability. But if there's just a character or characters at the heart of that story that really get somewhere, they go through a process in which they arc and they feel like they've really, you know, empowered or inspired or an anti-hero, whatever the nature of that story is, has done it in a way that really feels like it's either relatable or compelling or both, then I think you're on to something. if you tell it well. And if you happen to wrap it around those other elements that I think really move the needle for how we go about exposing material, something I can pitch really cleanly and fit into a genre that has a built-in audience and, you know, has a certain amount of cinematic elements that feel like it justifies the expense of being put onto a screen, that it does have a visual component, so it's not just a bunch of talking heads, although there is a kind of movie and show that has talking heads that can work really well if written really well. So it's just a different type of storytelling. But, you know, these aspects all brought together into a confluence of excellence can really be something special and a synergistic piece of material at the end of the day when it comes to its elements all rising up and elevating. So, you know, I think if someone's got their heart in the right place with their character and they focus on that character's journey, you know, that's a really great place to position their storytelling.
Confluence of excellence. I love it. That's amazing. The next question is by John Charles. John Charles said, Scott seems pretty well established and has a great client list. I'd love to hear some more about how he got started in management and what he did in the early part of his career to help get himself and new writers staffed or get them work. I'm just going to interject quickly saying that Scott did talk about his background in previous podcasts. You can go to scriptsandscribes.com, and we have a lot of interviews with Scott. You've been on the show. I think you're our Alec Baldwin of the show, meaning you've been on so many times, so you've talked about a lot. But maybe you can just give a quick brief explanation about how you got started, but more importantly, I think, how you got yourself and new writers staffed and got them work at the earlier stages of your career versus now when you're obviously pretty well established.
Yeah, as you know, like the most, you know, entertaining, comprehensive answer to that is something we don't have time for, and I think I've touched on that in other podcasts.
Right.
I guess just jumping ahead then, because I think it's hard to tell my backstory in an elevator pitch that has any sort of substance. So I'll just skip to the substantive part of that question, which is how do you kind of activate the careers of younger writers? It seemed like he's asking in television and what I've done with my clients. So like, yeah, everyone I've ever worked with across the board, film and TV, has always been someone that was plucked from virtual obscurity from under a rock that did not have any shred of viability or awareness that it became incumbent upon me to expose them in a way in which got their career activated in the most exciting way. And I love that. Like, I'm all about, I always say to clients, like, the value you have right now is that you're completely anonymous. You're not timestamped. You have no expectations. You can write your future based on the touch point that you put into the world with this piece of material and your personality now. There's no reinvention. There's no having to kind of like slip into someone's slipstream. You can just be you. Let's do it the best version of you now. And then people on television, like in TV, if you can get yourself into one of the writing programs, I think people have heard of, that's a really great platform in which to get notoriety and get experience. Usually reps come calling once I've signed people out of those programs, or someone that's, you know, gotten a little bit of traction from their own due diligence, getting a writer assistant job. Like, it does help as a representative to know that they've got that half of a foot in the door, and then I'll help them get through the door and then stay in the room. And if someone comes from like virtually nothing and doesn't have any relationships, and I will probably advise them in the same way. I'll be like, we're going to be putting your best material out there in the hands of executives and producers who will read you, hopefully want to meet you generally and build those relationships, see if we can get staffing opportunities. But you should be doing your own due diligence as well and submitting to those contests, or to those fellowships, seeing if you get accepted, because it is an elite class and it is a great training ground. And then ultimately, it always comes down to, we just have to position your material with the right people to get on available shows. And you're going to start at the staff writer level. Staff writer levels are quite often historically reserved for promotion from a writing assistant or a diversity hire. So there is kind of limiting elements in which you can position there, unless material is utterly outstanding and just kind of brushes off all of those previous criteria. But once you're kind of like positioned for that staff writer job through various processes of submissions and pitches and meeting showrunners and getting the job, then you're at the, you've got your seat at the table, and then it becomes a completely original dynamic process of just trying to navigate the room and enfranchise your colleagues and continue to want to be hired by them, or at least do good enough job that we can pivot that into a new job. But when you're starting out, I just need a strong piece of material, and then your help trying to make sure that you're positioning yourself with that material in more the ancillary opportunities that the market presents. And then we're kind of taking, you know, we're trying to approach it from all different lanes to lead to Rome.
Now I'm going to run by a few log lines. We're in the middle of our log line madness competition, and you are obviously generously giving up your time to be one of our judges, but I want to run a few log lines by you just sort of on the air on the podcast so that listeners can kind of hear critiques on what makes a log line good, what log line, you know, what is unnecessary in log lines and what it needs.
Yeah.
Things like that. So I'm going to read a couple, just three to you, and just see what you what your take is. The first is it's called Wildlife. It's a feature drama, and I'll read the logline twice just so you can kind of take it in.
Mm-hmm.
The logline goes, when his older brother commits a mass shooting at his small town high school, a young boy must keep his family from fighting the charges or risk being excommunicated from what remains of his community. I'll read it one more time. When his older brother commits a mass shooting at his small town high school, a young boy must keep his family from fighting the charges or risk being excommunicated from what remains of his community. Thoughts?
It's certainly topical. You know, it's very much touching the nerve of subject matter that we're all aware of and many people have been unfortunately affected by. Material like that, I think it does have to be told in a very sensitive manner. It has to be done in a way, and the execution has to be immaculate. These characters have to pop, and all these other things that you really can't determine until you look at the script. And that's just the nature of dramas. From a logline standpoint, I really like it, actually, because it automatically sets up this dilemma for the family, which is they have a child, an older child that clearly has issues, that did something terrible. They may not even really knew that this child was capable of that. Maybe they did. But regardless, their bond of love is going to have them feel like they need to defend their child in some way. And then the younger brother, which I think is an interesting protagonist, putting into the eyes and the perspective and the burden of a child to have to navigate a very sensitive, a very devastating process with the family, to have them say our reputation, our future in this community will be destroyed if we defend what my brother and your child did. And we've got to, we have to be sensitive to the, to other people and not just try to protect our own. And that feels like it's going to be, it could have the potential for a lot of drama and a lot of emotion and a lot of conflict within that family, within that community. So I think there's something very strong about that. Now, it is a drama, which means that like it is, it doesn't become like that instant thing that everyone wants to buy, because it's going to be contingent upon like how castable these characters. Having a young child as a protagonist automatically limits casting viability. But again, if it's really, really strongly written, I do like where he's coming from with the story he's want to tell. I lean into controversial subject matter. I think it's kind of like a cousin to commercial subject matter, because it automatically gets people's interest. It can just be more polarizing from the outset versus, you know, everyone genuinely curious about or excited about something. But I don't really have any critique. I have more praise for that log line than I do criticism as written. I would probably want to read that script off of that log line, with the probably the caveat being it's that writer's got to be pretty damn good to pull that off.
Right. I would, in terms of my feedback, I would just, on a very sort of picky, nitpicky sense, switch out a couple words, like a young boy must keep his family from, I would put stop. It seems much more forceful and active than just kind of keeping his family from fighting the charges. Also, keeping just, I don't know, it doesn't sound like a strong enough word It's just a word choice thing. And then or risk being excommunicated and just drop the or risk. Just, trying because they're going to be excommunicated from the community.
Yeah, no, I think that's good feedback. Just, yeah, I wasn't quite assessing it that
granularly,
but
absolutely.
From your critical standpoint, I do think, yes, every word matters in a logline. You've only got about 20 of them to work with.
Right.
You want to be super efficient. You want the most punctuating language that really, gets to the heart of it. So yeah, when I analyze a logline for market, we'll get down into the nitty gritty like that.
Sure.
The overall nature of that logline and what he's trying to accomplish with what he's trying to sell about his story and his characters, I think is fundamentally working.
Sure. And what about the title, Wildlife?
I like it.
Good.
It's a little confusing because like wildlife, if it's two words
it is
versus one word. Yeah. Two words is better because then it doesn't confuse it with like animals.
Right. Right.
It doesn't fully, I think it's a wild experience or going through wild sometimes has a positive connotation. We'll just feel like it's going to be more like a negative experience.
Mm-hmm.
So like, but again, it's provocative. It suits, it's a little off the nose. It sounds like it has some subtext to it, as should the story. So I think it kind of suits that. It's as little as I know about the story, the script, it suits what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested about that title with that story.
Oh, good. The next one's called Avila, and it's a psychological thriller feature. And the logline is, two brothers tasked with spreading the ashes of their late father get sidetracked when one of the brothers finds a hidden treasure buried deep inside Avila National Park in Caracas, Venezuela. I'll read it one more time. Two brothers tasked with spreading the ashes of their late father get sidetracked when one of the brothers finds a hidden treasure buried deep inside Avila National Park in Caracas, Venezuela.
I like this one too, in the sense that it looks like it's focused on a central relationship after a hardship that will lead to emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something there that existed before the story that applies the emotional groundwork. And then finding something that, was valuable and unexpected in a way, and it didn't reek of a contrivance for me.
Sure.
Like, we happened to be setting the ashes and found this, like setting it in Venezuela is very kind of sexy and could be potentially dangerous. I think what the logline could use is an implication of what's at stake in finding this treasure. Like, what is the mythology to it? What is the danger that comes from finding it? Like, upon finding the treasure and then sets into a chain of motions with, like, people that were also after the treasure or something maybe less cliched than that. But
right. What
it
is,
feels
what is
like,
the thriller aspect of it?
Yeah, feels like it says, I know it's a psychological thriller, so maybe it's just people in the woods debating about what they should do with this and there is no external conflict, which maybe the nature of that story, which I think does limit its commercial potential and its dramatic effect. But if that's what it is, that's what it is. And that logline suits it. But if there is an element of the story of an external conflict closing in on them as a result of stumbling upon this treasure, then I think that should be reflected in the logline because it will then make me feel like I have a clearer sense of the stakes.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to be the nitpicky one. But I would say things like two brothers tasked with spreading it. If I would change that word tasked to something like forced to, something that makes it much more, that has more energy and more power and more oomph to it. And then like they get sidetracked. It just sounds like two guys wandering in the woods go, oh, well, it's going this direction, as opposed to, maybe their plans go astray, wildly astray, or, something like that to give it add a little more energy there and then rather than sidetracked. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think again.
But
like
I think
I said
what you
before,
said about the
in a more
thriller
critical
aspect
sense.
Of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm looking at these things a little bit more of an overview. But I do agree with you, Kevin, that once you kind of got the log line down, then focus on the best language.
Sure.
Like
yeah.
I think that like that, that's it could make a difference, but you gotta make sure the fundamentals are as strong as they can be and then work on the verbiage.
Yeah, no, and the thriller aspect of it is exactly, I think that hits the nail on the head. That's sort of what's missing there.
Yeah.
And the title Avila?
I have no idea what it means. It's interesting.
I think it's the national park. It's
oh, yeah, that's what you said, Avila National Park. So, yeah, again, no one's going to know what that is unless they see a trailer or they see, like, the context in which presented. So it might be enough to have someone kind of say, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, it's not ideal because I think it just brings so much confusion.
Hmm.
But sometimes that's good as long as it's immediately followed up with some sort of context.
Right.
Where it sounds like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And maybe if the environment of that park becomes like a character in the story, it's the primary setting, and it seems to have a presence and an energy to it, an atmosphere to it, then the title makes even more sense because it seems less arbitrary.
Sure. And I would say the title's the name of the park, and I'm assuming that that's why they use in the logline the name Avila National Park in Caracas, Venezuela.
Yeah.
What I would suggest maybe is, I don't know. I think that maybe deep inside the Venezuelan jungle just sounds more threatening and ominous than a national park. I don't know. Anyway, that's just my thought.
Yeah, if it is a national park, then, like, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, you can juke that a bit to make it seem like a more, like, unregulated region of the world that could have more danger to it.
Right.
But, yeah, like, you can cheat by putting the name of the park in the log line. But reality is log lines don't translate. Like, there's no log line before, unless it's the tagline.
Right.
You know, so, like, they're going to have to figure out, like, ultimately, and believe, titles are important enough going out, but titles are decided by marketing.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't go too nuts with that. As long as it suits the script and it feels like the best thing we could come up with, then that's fine.
Yeah. And the last one is called Adopted Family. It's a drama feature. And the log line is, a successful doctor stuck in a comfortable marriage finds out he has a 5-year-old son from an affair, now adopted. Would he risk everything he has to reclaim his child back? I'll read it one more time. A successful doctor stuck in a comfortable marriage finds out he has a 5-year-old son from an affair, now adopted. Would he risk everything he has to reclaim his child back?
So just to clarify, because I just want to understand the dynamics is, and it's kind of not hearing it properly, is this child been adopted by another family? Is that what it's stating? Like this 5-year-old child he had with some other random woman has been adopted by a different family.
I'm guessing that that's the case. That's what it sounds like. But the fact that there's confusion means
the mother of the child is not the parent.
I guess that's what it sounds like. But again, the fact that we're sort of debating this right now means the log line has wording issues.
And it just makes me wonder, like, why. Like why that's literally the title of this adopted's in the title. So the writer must feel it's important that this man discovers that his child isn't with the mother.
Right.
It's with random people he doesn't know.
Sure.
And that's what compels him to think about maybe going in and being a part of this child's life, because he literally has no biological father figure, where if his mother was around, then at least he'd be with his mother.
Sure.
So that's what I'm interpreting. That should be worded in a way that's clearer. But assuming that's the case, then I think I generally like it. I think it creates a dilemma for a character that sounds like he's kind of at a point in his life where he could use some disruption, maybe on a spiritual level or something he's unaware of, that he's reached a state of complacency or ennui, and there's something missing. And the fact he discovers at this juncture in his life, he has an unknown child that is in a family life that he knows nothing about. And then he wants to go in and see if there's something he can do to be a part of that child's life. That creates an interesting question that I'd be curious to see how the answer of its execution is laid out in the story. Now it's a drama. So again, like Wildlife, purely execution dependent, entirely contingent upon how well written those rules are for it to feel like it has any type of strength in the market. But I do think it's a relatable idea. Everyone, you know, most of us out there have, you know, become parents in our lives, and how would we relate to that scenario if we found out, especially as a man who doesn't always know whether or not you had a child. Like, that's just a real thing. Guys just don't always know. Like, it's very possible that a woman they were with got pregnant and did not tell them, and they find out years later. Like, that's a real thing that exists, and I think that's relatable. So for the most part, aside from the confusion, I like it about whether or not the it's an adopted family, which I think is the case. It could just a word tweak or two to make that clear. And then reread the last part after the now adopted part. What? How does he close that off? What's
It
the
sounds like a
tale?
tag. It's would he risk everything he has to reclaim his child back?
Yeah, think about like risking everything he has. Like, I don't know what he had. I know he's a doctor with a comfortable lifestyle. So maybe that's like he's wealthy and he has a new family. And that's the thing. Like, can you read it one more time? I want to be able to compare front to back.
Yeah, a successful doctor stuck in a comfortable marriage finds out he has a 5-year-old son from an affair, now adopted. Would he risk everything he has to reclaim his child back?
I would say. The fact he says stuck in a comfortable marriage makes it seem like it's less of a risk to go after this because it sounds like he wants out of that relationship based on how it's worded. I think it should be almost like it should be worded in such a way that like the life he's in is the life that he wants. And then when faced with the possibility of a choice to go after something that could be, you know, he could be responsible for or very curious about. He then runs the risk of destroying that marriage. It sounds it
Nice.
just sounds to me like, you know, the risk is lower as a result of saying he's stuck in a comfortable marriage.
Right.
So maybe it's about removing that element or the verbiage that make it sound like it's like something he wants to escape from anyway, and this is the opportunity where it really I would lean into the fact it's a dilemma of like if he chooses this over that, he loses one over the other potentially, and that would be a devastating loss on either side.
Right.
Versus, like, I went and found my kid and I got rid of that wife I didn't want to be with anyway.
Right. And I think that stuck is that word because assess.
Stuck is the word, and
Yeah.
comfortable is
Yeah.
also, I think, a negative
Loaded.
connotation in that
Sure.
sense.
Yeah. I mean, if it said a successful doctor happy in a comfortable marriage, I mean, that's not ideal. Comfortable, it definitely has that sort of feel of complacency, of happy with what you have, but not. Really happy?
Well, it sounds to me that the script is probably written so that he's not in a good life. It's not an ideal life, and he's yearning for something more. And then cosmically, this
Sure.
information comes in that says that. But from a conflict standpoint, it weakens the stakes, but it
Right.
could create more fulfillment for the character to like be able to go find something he wanted and not feel guilty about what he's leaving behind.
Right.
But that guilt is what's interesting to play off of. And the harder the choice is, the Sophie's choice, that's a great place to put a character. And it's the writer's job to get him out of that.
Yeah.
Versus this seems like his answer seems a little bit foregone to a degree for me, which is
Yeah.
like go after your kid. And if the kid wants you in their life, then of course you're going to try to be responsible for that kid. He's your biological child. You
Yeah.
didn't know he existed.
Yeah. I do think that stuck in a comfortable marriage thing could be the tricky part, and also with the last of the tag, would he risk everything he has to reclaim his child back? Reclaim and back, I think, are not necessary. But I think
Well,
that.
he never had reclaim and back suggested he was a part of that child's life to a degree,
Right.
too. I think it's like more about would he risk everything he has to be the father he never was,
Yeah, no, that's great.
you know,
Yeah, something like
something like
that.
that, like
Yeah.
something that he's going after something for the first time that he's always wanted or feels he's responsible for versus something that he has to fix or do
Right.
again.
Yeah.
It sounds inaccurate.
Yeah. And then I would love to, like with the stuck part, I would love to see the risk heighten because you mentioned it only, you only really think about the risk in that tagline. There's no, it's not in the actual first part of the log line, which I would love to see. What?
Well, I think that it does imply, like I get the implication of risk when you're in an existing successful lifestyle, and then this could disrupt all of that.
Sure.
And also, there's going to be complications where if this is an adopted child with two loving parents,
Oh,
how
right.
do you convince them that he should be with you and not them? And what if that child is happy with them? Like
I
again,
got
all
the
that would be.
affair part, but that part about the two parents, that's a good point. But I if that's something like that is the case, I would love to see it because I didn't get that from it.
Yeah, and this is a new conceit. It was a film that came out about 10 years ago, a friend of mine made called Like Dandelion Dust, which was the same concept of a child was adopted by a really help, but it's from the point of view of the adopted parents. Then the biological parents come back for the child, and they're not the nicest people, but they are the biological parents. So like then the adopted parents are trying to protect their child from what they believe is not a healthy lifestyle. So like, but like, it's a very different way in. That's why, you know, that movie was very good, but not really well known. But I think this one puts you in a, they're both relatable standpoints. Like they're both trying to do the right thing. I'd be interested to see how they characterize the adopted family, though. In that other movie, it's really easy to make a choice. Like, obviously, you're gonna side with the adopted parents, trying to protect this child from like criminal parents, biological parents. In this case, if the other parents are wonderful, it creates an even more challenging dynamic where it's like, who has a right to what child based on biology or based on someone that legally adopted them and that child's happy. But again, that's all interesting and can be explored within the narrative.
Right. And it leads to the title, Adopted Family. I was going to ask you if you like it, but now I'm thinking Adopted Family. The title is named after, I'm assuming, what is the new adopted family of
Yeah, it's not like the
child.
Point of view is wrong.
Right.
It's from the point of view of the adopted family. Also, it sounds a little bit like a comedy to me, but that the title, but that also maybe sounds like because the Instant Family with Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne. And so I just think, you know, it usually comedy titles are really on the nose. And that's why that adopted family doesn't sound like a drama. It sounds more like you're kind of playing up the adopted element. So the title is very clean and clear. So that's good. But I don't know if it suits the tone.
Yeah. I agree.
So it's maybe sometimes titles like that, drama titles are sometimes best reverse engineered from how well your story turns out.
Right. Yeah. That's it. That's cool. That's all the log lines. Thanks again, Scott, for spending a little time chatting with us today. Always a
pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you,
Scott. Of course, keep doing what you're doing, bringing us all together. Continue to be safe and healthy. And to all the writers out there, keep writing. Keep reading, keep dreaming, and then, you know, it'll all fall into place if you believe in yourself.
And thank you guys all for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please give us 5 stars, a like, or a thumbs up, wherever you listen to your podcast. We appreciate it. And we have a Discord server that's growing pretty quickly, a new Patreon with some cool supporter exclusives. And you can also find the links on our Twitter at ScriptsScribes or on our website, scriptsandscribes.com, where we also have interviews with hundreds of other top industry professionals, many with Scott himself. So if you're serious about breaking into the industry, check it out. It's all free. And remember, keep writing, and we'll catch up with you next time.